Welcome to Decode, a podcast that delves into the complex world of K-12 computer science education, highlighting the significance of storytelling in comprehending educational data.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Decode podcast. I'm your host, Stanley Bucheski, CEO of PyTop. We're a computer science and robotics education company. And we're here with Dr. Ray Sanchez, superintendent of the Union Free District of the Tarrytowns in Westchester, New York. You might be wondering, what is Decode and why? It really came about as a result of conversations with district superintendents where this word equity has repeatedly surfaced. What are you doing to create equity in computer science? And as I looked at the data on gender and racial participation in computer science education, I saw these massive disparities, which was very disheartening, but the data also didn't make sense to me. And it seemed that every person that I spoke with had a different viewpoint or opinion about the data. And it made me think of my first year at West Point as a cadet, where they break you down and then they rebuild you. They force you to unlearn certain biases or things that you thought were true and relearn other things to help you become a better leader. Decode is an effort to unlearn some biases, to seek some truth, and to find some solutions so we can provide good computer science education to all kids. So Dr. Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us here today. I'm really grateful that you took the time to share some of your insights. And I guess I would just like to give you a chance to introduce yourself. You know, you actually grew up in Tarrytown, the district that you're now superintendent. What's it like coming back to your hometown to be the leader of its schools?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you for the opportunity to join you and look forward to this conversation. And I'm currently the superintendent in the public schools of the Tarrytowns. And as you noted, I was born and raised in this community. Mom still lives in the community. It's probably the hardest part of my job because mom periodically is reaching out to me, say, why haven't you come to visit? But I need to remind her that, you know, the work is just as intense as it was in another community, and in a positive way. I mean, it's an honor to come back and to be able to serve a community where I was born and raised and where my family first resided when they came from Cuba. I'm first generation, and many of my family members came to Tarrytown. I just look forward to supporting the community, doing, you know, the best I can to support staff and the students and to continue to elevate our practice. And, you know, as it feels to come home, and in many ways, I was in, you know, a previous district for 25 years. That was home, too. So it's like going from home to home in many ways. So yeah. But very excited about the opportunity I have before.
Well, I imagine being a district superintendent and, you know, being responsible for the education of all the kids in the district becomes very, very personal. And you probably build a lot of personal relationships with families and parents. And, yeah, I can see how it would become home.
Yeah, you know, to your point, it's, all our work is built on relationships. So, you know, it's really about getting to know and understand our families and then building systems around that, you know, to be responsive to who the students are that you have before you. And, you know, I often say, you know, kids shouldn't have to fit our system. We need to fit our system around the children. And so that takes really understanding who they are, honoring their identities, and then creating pathways for them to succeed. And, you know, while they're in the system and then on into life, whatever they choose to do after graduating.
I was wondering, you know, coming back to Tarrytown, I'm kind of comparing what it was like as a student in the district. Are there things that you experienced as a student or a child in your town with immigrant parents that you had wished were being provided to you as a student that sort of, I don't know, triggers some thoughts and ideas now as you come back to Tarrytown?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think one of the things that we're trying to create, and I think we're just more knowledgeable and more understanding, and we have more opportunities to collaborate, is the importance of collaborating with the community. And that's what the schools are doing, trying to bring in resources and have the schools be the hub for those resources. Just to give you a sense, we just brought in free dental services for all students in two of our schools and hoping to expand. like those are really, you know, that benefits all. And in lieu of families having to go out both within the community of Tarrytown or Sleepy Hollow or outside, you know, they can come to the schools and know that everything is there for them. And so that's
pretty amazing. I mean, I was at a school in the Bronx a couple of years ago, and they actually had basically an urgent care clinic right in the building. Right. And as I started thinking about it, wow, I mean, not only does that enable the parent to get access for their students to medical care, but also the idea of coming to the school, taking the kid out, driving to whatever clinic you have to go to, and then coming back. I mean, you got a whole day off of work that you got to take just to do that.
Yeah. So to your point, in my previous district, now we're just, you know, trying to explore the options, but we did have school-based centers in many of our schools. And, mm-hmm. And again, that benefited all kids. You can get your physicals, you can get your, you know, for those that played sports, they can get that all completed. If you weren't feeling well, you know, and it was beyond what the school nurse provides, you can go to the school-based health center to see if you can get, you know, your strep test or anything else. And that's just a benefit to our families, right? So, you know, we know that, let's just use any form of appointment. It's never 20 minutes in and out. It's almost like a full day out of work to go and care for your child. And if you can get some more information and it can be addressed, in this case in school, and I think that's just a benefit to everyone. And if you're working on an hourly wage and you're having to leave work, you know, that's income loss at the same time. So we're just trying to think of things to really support all families. And that's just, and those are opportunities that we're seeking to create and have had the opportunity to create in other districts.
Well, so you said free, and obviously nothing's free. Good Most point. Things aren't free. I mean, I could probably name a few things, but dental care is definitely not free. How did you pay for it?
That's just a partnership we have with the local school-based health center. Mm-hmm. So we're not paying for it. And if parents have insurance, they're covered. You know, they would charge their insurance, but no co-pays. Otherwise, if you don't, then you still get the services. So those are grants that they've received right. to help support it. So similarly with the school-based health center, if you have right. the insurance, you would be covered. Again, no copay, so that's a benefit to the
that's
families.
That's a partner organization whose mission yes. is to provide this to schools, and they've gotten their funding, whether it be through state or federal grants or charitable right. contributions, something like that. But it's just not right. something you don't have to worry about.
Correct. Wow. Yeah. So it doesn't impact the local taxpayers in this case.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, the phrase that you talked about when we spoke last, really stuck with me. And I guess it's relevant. I was actually going to use it to lead in to kind of who's paying for it. But you called it, you said it was organized abandonment. And I loved that phrase, because I think schools have to constantly be choosing. I mean, so do businesses. Everybody, I guess, has to be constantly choosing what they put their resources towards. And it's not like you can just keep adding stuff, right? Computer science education, for example.
Correct.
Add it with taking away something else. And so that term organized abandonment, I don't know, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So it's just a phrase, you know, it's not a phrase, but it's a, well, it is a phrase, I should say. But it's also a philosophy and a way of thinking. So, you know, in education, and to your point, even in business, you know, you can keep seeking to add, but we look within to see what's working and not working. And if I want to bring something new to the district or to my school or to my classroom, I might be able to give something up in order to get this new initiative or program that might be equal in value, mm-hmm. but it's going to have a greater impact on our students. So to your point, and, you know, whether it's STEM or computer science or, you know, if we want to bring in that program or programs like that or more opportunities, we can look from within and maybe look for areas that, you know, we can find efficiencies where maybe they're just, you know, number one, we may not have the enrollment for, kids aren't as interested. Two, we're not seeing the data move or the results. And we think that bringing in said opportunities are going to be better for our students. So I can go back to my board of education. I can go back to our local residents and say, I'm going to bring this in. And all I'm doing is not only just giving one thing to get something else. So that's a starting point. And I share that in all our budget processes is to start there, look to see what's working. Make sure, you know, let us be ready to give up. Although, you know, not sometimes things take time. You know, you might need to give something at least our initiative 3 years to see if it's really, really working. But eventually, you know, we have to be honest and data will tell us both qualitative and quantitative if something's working. And that's when we make some decisions about things will continue and things that we'll give up and things that we're going to add at the same time.
Not everyone may know this, but you're about 8-9 months into the job, came from Ossining. So you've been doing a lot of listening the past 9 months, not to get you in trouble or anything early on, because you have to do some persuasion, I'm sure. But any initial thoughts on things you might give up or things you might add as a trade-off?
Yeah, no, and it's good timing. We're in the midst of our budget process right now, and we're looking really carefully at how we're allocating some of our staff. We want to bring in more STEM opportunities for our students, K-5, to build that out. Right now, we have offerings at our 3-5 building, and those are grades 3-5, and we want to kind of bring it down to lower grades and provide more opportunities. And, you know, we've moved around and shifted some staff as a result of that. And we've been very public about what we were doing. Mm-hmm. The other part of it, too, is that in doing so, we were also able to, you know, we anticipate, because it's all pending a budget being approved, moving some of those other staff members over to, like, let's just say at the high school, to provide more elective opportunities for students. So, you know, in truth, the system benefits overall. So we're in the midst of that, but STEM is one of the areas that we're hoping to expand. So anyway, we're looking at that in the course of our schedule right now. But it's collaborative in nature. It's not just me. You know, I'm just bringing to everyone's attention and asking everyone to go through with a fine-tooth comb and saying, you know, how might we better serve our kids or serve them in a different way? And does the whole system benefit from this reorganization? And we're finding benefits to the point of recommending it to our community.
Well, I was very excited to hear that you're implementing it at the K-5 level. Definitely has come up several times, and certainly in one of our previous podcasts about the mandates that the states are generally passing. And Code.org, a big advocacy organization that lots of people are aware of, have really led the charge on a large set of legislative mandates for each of the states, but one of them is mandating that schools offer computer science. And most of the legislation is targeted at high schools. And it's almost too late by the time kids get to high school to help them really get exposed to anything computer science related or STEM related. I don't want to say it's too late, but certainly if you can get them exposed at the earlier grades, don't you think the barriers to taking some of those electives go way down if they have some positive experience?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think quite honestly, you know, in this case, we're trying to start at kindergarten. You know, there's age appropriate ways in which to begin dialoguing with students and providing these set opportunities. And I think to your point, I don't think it's too late to, if you did it and you had to do it at the high school, but if we can start exposing and think about it systematically as an entire system from the early grades and engaging our families around the value and importance of this, I think it, you know, all students will benefit. And at the same time, we might begin to see some shifts in some of the data that we're seeing, you know, hopefully seeing more girls enter or women, you know, enter the field, you know, really trying to address issues and inequities that we're seeing in some of the data as it relates to computer science and STEM fields.
Right. Well, I'm going to throw out some data for you. It's not something you're not familiar with, so I'm not going to surprise you here. But your district, just the demographic breakdown, 60% Hispanic, 31% white, 3% Black, 3% Asian. And I think you're at around 19% ELL or multilingual learners. Now we're talking. When you look at that data and then you look at the families that you've met and talked with already, what are you seeing are some of the unique needs of your district, given that ethnic and kind of, I guess, immigrant population breakdown?
Yeah, you know, it's a diverse district, in other words. It's not, there's a lot of, and there's beauty in that, but it also presents some challenges. And so we're looking constantly, particularly when we're looking at socioeconomic components, is making sure that all students have opportunities. And that comes with really thinking carefully about how to allocate resources and ensuring that all students have access to high quality programs and access also to opportunities that are going to enlighten them of potential careers and opportunities that they have to potentially pursue down the road. And so, you know, again, it goes back to even just the early STEM conversations. Like, I want to provide them opportunities. I want to expose our students to what it is like to go to college. I want to expose them to careers that sometimes there are barriers to that for some families. And I think it's incumbent upon me as a superintendent, along with our school's staff and board, to dismantle some of those barriers and that everyone truly has access so that they can be successful. And that, you know, in light of the demographics and some of the challenges, you know, particularly as it relates to socioeconomic status, that is, you know, that's a barrier for some. And so that's the work. And we work with our community, partner with a variety of organizations to make sure that, again, access is provided and opportunities are provided and that the opportunities that are provided are high quality ones as well.
You know, I want to talk about access and I want to talk about jobs and college pathways in a moment, but I'm also curious for your population. There's kind of this term access versus equity, and I kind of think of equity as participation, and often, and people may have different views on it, but when you think about the provision of services versus participation in whatever services being provided, let's talk computer science, obviously, but in a lot of schools or districts, computer science is being provided. So the access is there, but there are lots of biases. And you mentioned, for example, getting more girls involved in this. And there are definitely biases that are out there. I'm curious, and a lot of them are false, right? And I'm curious kind of for your population, both for girls or for a large Hispanic population or the other ethnicities in your district, are there specific biases that you're seeing that you're trying to debunk?
Yeah, you know, I'm not trying to avoid the question, but I'm still, you know, being 9 months in, I'm still trying to understand the data and understand what those might be. But, you know, quite honestly, I think nationally, and we all face it, is just, you know, we see patterns and we can make general statements around the data that we're seeing and who's pursuing, you know, careers or opportunities in computer science. And I think some of that may be mirrored within the context of, you know, the local district. But I think very strongly that, you know, we need to begin having early conversations with our families. We need to have early conversations with our children. We need to show them that these are, you know, that everyone can participate. And, you know, sometimes the scaffolding and the opportunities might be different. But, and I appreciate what you're bringing up about participation is, you know, I try to look really carefully at who's in courses, and then discussing why, you know, when we see the numbers and we see the data, like what is precluding some of our students from wanting to participate. And that's incumbent upon us, because if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, we get the same results, right? That's, I believe that's the definition of insanity. So really delving deeper, you know, and see what's under the iceberg to determine what are the perceptions of families? What are the perceptions of potentially some of our students? Why not? Are they of interest? And what might we need to do as a school district to shift? That's our role. That's our responsibility.
And as you know, many of the biases that the students have come from students, not students, come from parents, come from teachers. And, you know, interestingly, I think there's a lot of fear among us adults around AI, for example, and, you know, lots of things tech related. And it's an area that it's interesting. You know, I'm hoping this time around we'll embrace this big tech revolution. Unlike when, you know, the cell phone came along, it was it's just crazy to me. The greatest learning device in the history of the world was widely banned in most schools. And I'm seeing that now. And I'm asking my kids, well, why didn't you just ask that of ChatGPT? Well, they looked at me sideways. They're like, what are you talking about, Dad? We're not allowed to use that in school. Right, so Anyway, there's some good organizations out there trying to help us put frameworks together. TeachAI.org, I think, was a sort of a sub-organization of code.org that's just come out with a framework for schools. Are you guys doing anything kind of looking at AI or?
Yeah, no, we've started to have conversations with staff. There's, I think generally speaking, and not necessarily specific to the staff in my school district, but, you know, it's human nature. We become fearful. We don't, you know, until we know what we feel like we don't know at this point, right? And AI, could, for some, view it as a threat, but there's opportunities in this, right? And so how do we embrace it? How do we use it? It's here. And blocking isn't necessarily the right answer. So we're having conversations with our staff, exposing them, helping them understand, and then hearing from them of how it can be used instructionally, and how we can use it to educate our students on the proper uses of it, or the value added or the power of a tool or the resource of that AI can provide. It's here, to your point, the question becomes, how do we embrace it and how do we use it to support instruction and support our children? Because, from day to day, I'm like amazed at the evolution, and it's moving rapidly. And I think we as educators need to kind of, again, embrace it and figure out how we use it within the context of our schools.
I gave a presentation to a large group of students and their computer science teachers at a Florida cyber competition recently. And we talked about kind of the differences between AI and humans and what AI is good at, what humans are good at, and the difference. And everybody is always fearful that technology is going to replace jobs. But in reality, jobs always increase as a result of new technology. It's just a matter of how long the displacement takes for some of those jobs and the ability to retrain. And it frees us up to do more. And the thing that really kind of came out of it was that AI is great at memory and at repeating tasks. So it's interesting as we apply that to Bloom's taxonomy. Right, it's the rubric that every teacher learns in their schooling, and I did a demo I'm calling it inverting Bloom's taxonomy, and we just forgot about the bottom thing, which is remember and understand and then apply it, and then we just started with creativity, and the goal was to teach higher order thinking and analysis and critical thinking and collaboration and all of the C's instead of the three R's. And we used ChatGPT to write code to create a game using some LED lights that we would plug into the Pi top.
Oh, wow.
And we just started doing a series of prompts as a group of students to write some Python code to create this game called, remember Simple Simon, where you press the buttons?
Yeah.
And incidentally, AI always wins because it's better at remembering things than we are.
Sure, and
it was really cool because we just continued to refine the prompts. We looked at the code and we saw little problems in it. And the students were able to come up with solutions to it. And I was there in front of 50 people doing this, and I completely failed, sort of. I failed to actually get the game to work at the end of the 50-minute period. And I asked the kids, I said, well, did we fail? And they're like, no, because the goal was to teach how to think rather than how to code the game. Well,
That's a great example. And I think that's the, sort of an overlay to all this is how do we use this to, and the kids noticed it, right? In your example, to think and think critically. And I think, there's a framework. I think it's SAMR, right? So it's S-A-M-A-M-R, and it's an acronym. And, when we thought about changes in technology, the first one is substitute, right? So, in many cases when we went to wipe, these smart boards, we substituted the chalkboard for these, for the whiteboards, right. But we didn't, and it was a direct substitution.
Chalkboard.
and it was an expensive substitution in some cases. If we weren't using it, and I think the R represents like redefining. And so in your continuum, how do we use now these, and I'll use the smart board analogy again, like how do we use that to redefine the way we're teaching and how do we use it as a different tool? And so as we start using AI, it's like, okay, so we can substitute, AI can substitute for something else. But how do we use it to redefine some of the learning and accelerate? Because there's real clear opportunities to do that.
Well, I wonder if the M is for mindset, because it was really eye opening, not necessarily for computer science teachers, but it's a shift in mindset from ChatGPT. That's just for cheating on essays. Well, actually, you can use it for some very really creative and useful things. I want to shift gears a little bit because you're talking about jobs and pathways and college, and I've been seeing this shift in mentality from all kids have to go to college because that's the only way you're going to be successful, to guess what, there are a ton of really lucrative and respectable jobs that you can get right out of high school, and guess what, computer science is applicable across many different areas of curriculum and jobs. It touches everything in our world, and you can get really good job skills right out of high school to get jobs. And we're looking at doing partnerships with local businesses and creating internships and really kind of pipe into the curriculum the skills that the job providers want their employees to have. And you're exploring some interesting things in that area as well, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, so we've said some preliminary conversations around this because to your point, we just want to make sure that irrespective of the, what students, when students, we want students to graduate, but then have choices. If they want to move right into the workforce and do and pursue a pathway, then they should, or pursue, a 2 or 4 year degree after that. And so we've had some preliminary conversations around ways in which we can partner and maybe create. But these are really preliminary certificate type programs where maybe students can, leave here with a certificate of with the skill set that employers are looking for via a pathway that's been created for them so that they can move into the workforce. And there's, there's an economic component to this that sometimes we're seeing, to the cost of, going to a 4 year college is extremely expensive. And for some, they may leave
out of the workforce for 4 straight years, right?
Right. So you might leave, high school with a paying job that might be $60,000 or $70,000. I'm just picking a round number. Mm-hmm. That gives you opportunities, and it doesn't preclude you from wanting to go back and get your degree if you want to. If you have a passion and that's actually what the employers are looking for, you might, very well move right into a career. And so those are, you know, we haven't solidified anything. It's just an exploration at this point. But, you know, I see those opportunities, and some high schools and some districts have started to create those opportunities for students. And I think we as systems need to really begin thinking in that direction as well.
Yeah.
And honoring it, you know, to be honest with you, there's real value added. And we had to you got to communicate that with our families who, you know, may only think that the only pathway is to go to college. And I think there's just options. And I think we need to provide those options.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by honoring it? Just following through with it?
You mean in terms of the moving into careers, you're saying?
You just said, you know, honoring the exploration of this idea of providing those job skills, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think quite honestly, we can't look at it as a no, you can't kind of point of view, or that's not the way we do. You know, you're going to pursue your life, right? Or you have to go on to the 4-year college. My point is that, you know, I want to honor the decisions that our students make and put them in a position with the skill sets to pursue whatever they want to pursue.
Right.
And
right.
If that means going into college right away, if it means into going to military, and that's a choice they make, they want to go into the, you know, pursue, you know, a higher institution of education, then I just want to make sure they have the skill set and that they've been provided opportunities to know what they want to pursue. And irrespective of what their decision is, I think we need to honor that part of it.
Well, one of the things that I've been excited about as we look at training students for jobs is the idea of partnerships with local universities or community colleges so that students, while they're going to high school, can get some college credits, which puts them in a position. I mean, it's just a triple win, really, right? It's a win in the sense that they get a sense for what it's like to take college level courses. You potentially get an associate's degree with some programs by the time you graduate high school. So you're on the path to already getting that degree. The universities love it because they've got a pipeline of students that are willing to work hard and have some goals.
Right.
We are actually starting to have some conversations with various community colleges and universities about making sure that our courses at PyTop actually teach the students the things that the universities are looking for, and hopefully eventually those courses can be used for credit at those universities.
Yeah, so I'm a strong proponent of the dual enrollment courses, where students can take the courses on a high school campus, but they're college level courses, and they can earn the credits towards an associate or transferring those very, you know, hopefully.
Does the university professor come there and teach the college, or they train the local high school teacher to do the courses?
Yeah, so they look at the credentials of our staff, and they have to be qualified enough to, they got to meet their requirements, and then they can be, they're capable, and they give them the syllabus that they would need to follow. So, you know, many of our local high schools, including, you know, Sleepy Hollow High School, have dual enrollment courses, which, and also it's very cost effective. They're, you know, I would say a quarter, if not a little less, of what a credit would cost you to go to, you know, on the campus of either a community college and or, a 4-year university.
Yeah. And you have a partnership with Monroe College in New Rochelle. Are you looking at that, or?
Yeah. So there's two things. We have a partnership with Westchester Community College. That's one. And then we're doing some explorations with, you know, university partners, including Monroe College, which is in New Rochelle. That is a private institution, but, you know, trying to see ways in which we can bring, you know, additional opportunities for our students, and also opportunities for multilingual learners, which are, you know, you referenced before, you know, English language learners. Mm-hmm. And because sometimes, because of requirements, they're not always, and because they're of the language barrier, meaning, and not barrier, but they're willing, their need to acquire the second language, in this case, English, they don't always have the, you know, the opportunities to take these higher level courses, but cognitively they're very capable. So what we're trying to do is provide more of those through partnerships like that with Monroe and others.
I want to ask you about that actually, because one of the benefits of working with them, you said, was the ability to actually take the courses in Spanish, because they have a couple of professors who are able to do that in the Spanish language. And I think some people would look at that and they would say, well, I'm not sure that is a good idea. That's you're basically enabling the student to not have to learn English. And as a result, maybe you're even creating some barriers and segregation among your various populations. How would you kind of debunk that viewpoint and maybe explain the benefits of teaching students in their native language?
Yeah, so, you know, first of all, I think one of the, I haven't met many individuals that haven't seen the value of knowing two languages. What's that?
I said it's a superpower now, right?
It's a superpower, right? So, you know, why are we, you know, the question is why, that's one of the greatest assets that students are coming in with. So we want to continue to foster that, right? And develop their L1, which is their first language, while they're acquiring L2, which is their second language, in this case would be English.
I love this point. Rather than abandon your prior language, your only focus is learn English, right?
And quite honestly, the other part of it too, the research shows, a student or an individual that is literate in their first language and is strong in their first language is learns the second language much faster, right? So there are basic concepts of print and others that, you know, irrespective of the language, they're consistent. So my point, you know, I guess to your point is, what I would share to everyone is that we're still intending to have students learn English. That's not what we're not doing. We're just using one of their strongest assets, which is their first language, teaching them content in many cases and continue to foster that while they're learning the second language. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I'm just trying to describe it out.
Yeah, 100%.
So, you know, and here we are, if I were to transition or move to another country and move into a high school, well, cognitively, I think, you know, if you offered the class in English, I can probably take some higher level courses while I'm learning the second language in whatever country I'm in. And it's not so different. We have students that are coming in with assets. They're very capable. All they're doing is, you know, what they need to do is learn English in this case. And so it's incumbent upon us to continue to challenge them and to, you know, pursue those passions that we just talked about, but maybe it's not in English, it's in Spanish. So, and they'll leave there hopefully bilingual, biliterate, and bicultural.
Well, I honestly could talk shop for another hour if we both had time and if people actually wanted to listen, but we're gonna wrap it up. I wanted to ask you, I love to end the podcast episode with just a message of positivity, something kind of on your mind or vision or message that you want people to hear about kind of the future of education or Tarrytown or anything that's on your mind.
Yeah. I appreciate that's probably the best way to end and begin something at the same time with just on a positive note. You know, there's obviously public education in schools and education as a whole is a continuous work in progress. You know, we're continuously thinking about how do we improve? How do we meet the needs? Cause you know, society's changing, interests are changing, technology is changing, and we need to change along with it. I'm seeing some initiatives starting to, you know, develop within the state that I, you know, our schools are in New York, that I'm very optimistic about. There's talk about different pathways for graduation and those types of discussions, I think are lending themselves. We're going to have an opportunity to innovate in ways that we haven't. And so those are, you know, that's my sense of optimism for us, because, you know, this sort of regulatory and policy development has sometimes from a mindset precluded us from thinking in those directions. But I think there's going to be a marriage between the way we know we want to move towards and what the state as a whole is beginning to think about in terms of, you know, requirements for graduation. And I think in the end, it'll be beneficial for our kids. And I think we're going to get even more excited about the way and manner in which we're offering opportunities for our students.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to have you have this conversation today. And I think the people of Tarrytown are very lucky to have you. And I'm wishing you all the best of luck in the coming years and with your budget. And what do we call it? Organized abandonment. So good luck to you. And I wish you all the best and a happy Easter.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. Good luck with everything as well.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. If you found this conversation valuable, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We will see you next time on Decode.